KNW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a polio survivor, among those sounding the alarm about efforts to undermine public confidence, he says, in proven cures, responding to reports about an attorney with close ties to RFK Jr. who may be involved in reshaping policy.
His name is Aaron Seary, and he's a close and trusted advisor of HHS Secretary nominee Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's been spotted at Mar-a-Lago and is said to be helping Kennedy choose staffers for the federal health agencies. In 2022, Seary asked the FDA to yank back its longstanding approval of the current polio vaccine, saying it was never properly tested when it was approved 34 years ago. It's one of several vaccines whose approval Seary has challenged.
ABC's Stephen Portnoy. The U.S. military flew Travis Timmerman from Syria to Jordan today. The American released after the fall of the Assad regime. He says he was jailed after crossing the border earlier this year. And a major winter storm has dumped several feet of snow in the Great Lakes region again. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm. For 97.9 WGBW News, I'm Lisa Hale. A Kakana man accused of shooting his father 15 times appeared in Outagamie County Court yesterday. 45-year-old Gregory Huedes is charged with first-degree intentional homicide and resisting an officer for the November 24th death of Daniel Huedes Sr. in Appleton. The criminal complaint does not state a motive for the murder, but in the ambulance after his arrest, Gregory Huedes told officers, quote, "I think I got him with every round," end quote. Bond was set at $2 million. Cash. Huedes will return to court January 2nd for a status conference. A dozen municipalities in our listening area will receive between $2,700 and $25,000 in urban forestry grant funds in 2025. Governor Tony Evers and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources announced the recipients this week. The grants will fund projects to increase the urban forest canopy, reduce carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and improve the quality of life and public health in the communities. The UF grant program will also advance goals outlined in Governor Evers' Trillion Trees Pledge commitment, which includes planting 1 million trees in urban areas by the end of 2030. A report from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction found that students in the state are struggling in standardized testing, specifically in math. The report found that less than half of public school students scored as proficient in math during the 2023-24 school year, and the school choice program students had a math proficiency rate of about 28%. Education officials cited the COVID-19 pandemic as one of the major reasons for the declining test scores, forcing students to learn virtually to prevent the spread of the virus. I'm Lisa Hale, 97.9 WGBW News.
Brewers trade Devin Williams. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers have traded closing pitcher Devin Williams to the New York Yankees for two players, left-handed pitcher Nestor Cortes and infielder Caleb During. Devin Williams had been named to the All-Star Game and Relief Pitcher of the Year twice, but suffered a blown save in a 4-2 loss to the Mets in the playoffs. Manager Pat Murphy after the game.
You see blips in every pitcher in baseball. It's not anything that doesn't happen to the best of the best. He is one of the best in the game, and it's not anything that doesn't happen to the best.
NFL Packers packing their bags for Seattle to play the Seahawks Sunday night. Defensive back Jaire Alexander will not play, still dealing with a knee injury. The 49ers' Devondre Campbell under fire after walking off in the third quarter last night in a game against the Rams, saying he didn't want to play. Campbell was a Packers linebacker last year who said he felt like a big brother to linebacker Quay Walker.
Me and Quay are the exact same person. The exact same person.
How so?
Just personality-wise.
That's Devondre Campbell with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
It's only up from here. With sunny skies today and temperatures rising all throughout the afternoon, even into the evening, and through tomorrow. They'll wind up flirting with the freezing mark tomorrow afternoon as a major system moves in, bringing a wintry mix of snow, sleet, and freezing rain. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot. Right now, it's 17.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when.
Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Jeffrey from Madison.
I worked for the city of Madison for 34 years. Act 10 cost me $42,000.
Yep.
In 1977, the state of Wisconsin passed a law that says public employees cannot strike. With Act 10, now we can't bargain for working conditions and benefits, so they basically turn public employees into second-class citizens.
Yes.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk about news deserts and what that means to our politics. We'll wrap it all up with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. I hope you can join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. From De Pere to Suamico, 97.9 WGBW. Broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and around the world on the Civic Media app. This is the Dom Salvia Show. And now, here's your host, Dom Salvia.
Welcome back. Happy Friday. Welcome in to the Dom Salvia Show. I'm Jimmy Cuska filling in today. I'm the sports director here at Civic Media. And yes, we will talk sports at some point in this show. In fact, coming up in a half hour, we're actually going to run through the proposal by the state High School Football Coaches Association on changing how teams qualify for the playoffs and how teams get seeded in the postseason. A fascinating proposal. I think for those of you who maybe not be as much into sports, I think you'll still get something out of it because this affects everybody in the state. And it should be a pretty fun conversation with Edgewood head football coach Jesse Norris as that process is happening right now. In the first hour, we talked a bit about the state budget. We talked a bit about the Enbridge Line 5 pipeline, some of the debate over that, some of the lawsuits filed over that. You can catch all that on the podcast coming up at civicmedia.us. But right now, we're going to turn our attention and talk a bit more about the biennial budget, in specifically talking about education and funding for it, but with a bit of a different take. I'm joined by Dr. Jamie Nutter, the agency administrator of CESA 3, which is in southwestern Wisconsin. Got to talk a little bit more about school funding now. First of all, thank you for joining me. You're a member of CESA in my part of the state, so I've had plenty of chances to talk to you over the past few years that I've lived over here since moving from by Madison. So it is great to have you on and talk to you a little bit about school funding and some of the ways forward with this.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity, Jimmy. It's a complex puzzle, and I really take pride in trying to simplify it for folks.
Well, let's start with this, because I want to make sure that people understand what CESAs do. CESAs have been in Wisconsin for decades, and they are there in support of school districts and education across Wisconsin. Could you explain what your agency does and what CESAs do across the state?
Yep. First of all, we are celebrating 60 years as a CESA, so we're really excited about that. We were created in 1965, mainly to help serve students with special needs. Prior to 1973, there was no federal laws mandating support, but communities and school districts felt, they had a moral obligation to serve all students. And so they didn't necessarily have enough resources so they could all individually be able to serve students. So CESAs were brought in to provide resources, training for school districts in the mid-60s. And in 1973, then obviously with IDEA coming in, it expanded. But what we do now, so if you think about CESA 3 in southwest corner, and our colleagues across the state are all unique, but we cover 4,000 square miles. We have 31 school districts and about 18,000 students, so we're fairly rural. The primary service that we do is provide those low incidence or hard to find positions. Teachers of the visually impaired, deaf and hard of hearing, school physical therapy, school occupational therapy, because each school could not afford to have their own. So then we expand that, and then we share services, and then they pay for that service based on use. So that's the first service that we provide. The second is we receive no funding from the state. We receive no funding, any required. Everything is voluntary, and our membership fees come from the districts. So, but DPI will contract with us because we have relationships regionally to provide training and meet mandates. And so then we work with the school districts to help with that. So that's the second piece, is providing those training opportunities required by state and federal mandates. And then finally, we provide professional development. So school districts every day are busy serving students. And so they don't always know what are the trends, what are the opportunities. Right now, AI is, you know, we're struggling with AI, and how do we bring that in so that we can enhance learning opportunities? Well, when you think about the day in the life of an educator, you know, they're focusing on that day to day without kind of looking to the future. So then we're bringing those trends and tasks and coming in and helping with state and national trends so that our students have the same educational opportunities as anybody across the country. And I said finally, I think in that third point, but this is the final. The other piece that we do is, since we are all small, we don't have buying power. So we bring people together, and we manage the consortium to get better deals on pricing. So that's kind of the, you know, that's the fourth leg of the stool that we provide. So those are just some highlights, and there's a lot that goes into that.
Well, I appreciate the explanation, because I know for people, even me, you know, a few years ago coming into it as a school board member, I wasn't entirely sure what CESA meant and what all that meant. So it's great to kind of get the rundown of that and explain where you're at as an agency administrator. Talking to Dr. Jamie Nutter from CESA 3. And the reason why we have you on is because, as you said, school funding is a very complicated topic. But it's also going to be a highlight of the biennial budget discussions in the legislature, especially already with Governor Evers touring the state here this month, talking about those ideas, what needs to be included in the state budget. We've already seen a very large request from the Department of Public Instruction for some funding from that as well. But what I thought was interesting in a publication that your CESA puts out called Cornerstone is you talked about something that wasn't necessarily tied to tapping into the state surplus or the vast number, the record-setting number of school referendum that have been put forward that ultimately require local property owners to pay a bit more in taxes. But talking about collaborative efforts in communities, and this really spoke to me as a way forward, because this is something that can be done right now. And also, does it have to necessarily be tied in to statewide politics? Can we talk a little bit about, you know, just some of the opportunities that might be there for communities and school districts to partner together in trying to tackle at least part of the school funding issue?
Yeah, so I think if you think about a couple of years ago, Forward Analytics, which is the data arm of the Wisconsin County Association, came out with some projections that stated that by 2030, Wisconsin would be 150,000 workers short of all jobs due to retirements, due to people moving out of the state. Well, obviously that impacts our schools and communities when we're based on enrollment. We're based on students and seats. And so as we think about our communities, we have to ask ourselves, right, what are we doing to solve that problem? What's our solutions right now when we think about it? The main culprit and the main problem that we're having, it's statewide, whether it's schools, private sector, any industry right now is facing shortages because of population needs. And so as a community, whether it's our city, whether it's our county, the same costs are there. But if we don't have more people to spread that cost to help pay for that, then we're all the same people are going to be paying for the same costs and more expensive costs. So right now, what's our solutions been? You know, I mean, so we're looking in the short term, and every time we you know, so this last biennium, we had historic inflation along with a fiscal cliff from the federal government. The federal government floated all schools for 2 years. That one-time money went away. We had to backfill that. But then we doubled that issue with historic inflation. So that's why we're seeing record referenda. Now, we have to do that in the short term. But every time we do that, it comes at a cost. There's a sometimes a misconception that schools aren't handling, finance correctly. And it's really money in and money out. It's the cost of educating students. So if we don't want to rely on referenda and we don't want to rely on the state, especially in rural areas where we have to rely on state aid or we just wouldn't be able to exist, we have to start thinking about growth. And that's hard, right? So we were in a collaborative meeting in one of our local counties, and they talked about the level of growth that had to happen every year. So if you think about all the growth, whether it's housing, businesses, and the value of what they have to increase to help share that cost with new construction, new businesses, they coined it, and I think I quoted that in the article. It had to be equivalent to one Walmart, 2.5 Quick Trips, or 50 to 70 houses. If you don't have that growth every single year, the people who are under that revenue cap have to pick up the inflation on that. So that's with inflation, that's what has to happen in order to break even. And so where do you start? I mean, you have to start having conversations. And so right now, the school does, in most communities, the school, they do their business. The city does their business. The county does their business. So what happens when we don't communicate? Well, the county has their needs, the city has their needs, and the school has their needs. And if their answer is that they're going to tax and they don't communicate and they try to get all of their answers at the same time, now the taxpayers are forced to fund that, it makes it difficult. But if they work together to think about growth, we can bring in even one or two houses. Now, is that 50? No, but that's still two more houses that are helping contribute to bring my cost down. When we bring somebody else in, they're sharing that burden because we have revenue caps, because schools and municipalities, they can't go over the revenue cap. So if more people are coming in, that threshold's not going to raise up. It's just more people helping fund and support our municipalities and schools. So that's kind of what was driving that. And then I worked with Southwest Planning. The leader over there is Troy Maggie, and he started talking about growth, and the light bulb clicked, and I'm like, yeah, we're just the schools and the school administrators and school boards are taking all this burden on, and everybody's mad at them. They're like thinking, hey, they're trying to solve a problem with the tools that they have. Yet, what's our communities doing to promote growth?
Dr. Jamie Nutter, the agency administrator at CISA 3. Jamie, would you be willing to stick around just a couple more minutes to wrap up some final thoughts on this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, we are talking to CISA 3 agency administrator, Dr. Jamie Nutter. We're going to talk to him coming up after the break. Coming up at the bottom of the hour in about 15 minutes, we are going to talk to Edgewood High School football coach Jesse Norris. He's one of a handful of coaches who have proposed a new way to qualify for the high school football playoffs in Wisconsin. We're going to go through it all with him and talk about that coming up in just a bit. Then coming up at 6, it is Pete Schwabba taking you through the night. That's coming up again at 6 o'clock, so about 40 minutes from right now. More Dom Salvia Show coming up next here on Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We reported recently on the impact of Shelby County versus Holder, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision invalidating Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Anticipating even more erosion of the VRA, some states have passed their own state VRAs. It's not only the dismantling of Section 5, the preclearance requirements for states with a history of discrimination. The conservative justices also made proving racial gerrymandering harder under Section 2, and they've made it easier for a state legislature to dilute minority voting power. and in the lower courts, more cases attempting to keep individual voters from bringing voting rights lawsuits under the VRA are pending. With dwindling protections from the federal government, California, Washington, Oregon, Virginia, New York, Connecticut, and Minnesota have enacted state VRAs. Michigan, Maryland, New Jersey, and Florida have efforts underway. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund recommends that state VRAs should have preclearance requirements for municipalities which have patterns of discrimination. Rules should include a prohibition against vote denial or dilution through gerrymandering, strong protections against intimidation or deception, language assistance, a statewide database to make evidence-based decisions on election administration, and a directive to the state judiciary to support pro-voter and pro-democracy decisions. We have the recommendations at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Todd Alba Show.
Cash Patel, who Trump has nominated to be the head of the FBI, saying he wants to basically shut down the main parts of the FBI. Bill Barr, MAGA Republican Attorney General to Donald Trump. Quote, the very idea of moving Patel into a role like this showed a shocking detachment from reality. Unquote. This is not the left calling out Patel. This is the right.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Welcome back. It's the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media. I'm Jimmy Cuska, the sports director here, filling in. We're going to talk high school football coming up in about 10 or 15 minutes with Edgewood football coach Jesse Norris on the Wisconsin football coach's proposal to change how teams get into the playoffs and how they are seated once they get there. But right now we are talking to CESA 3 agency administrator, Dr. Jamie Nutter.
We're talking about a very complicated subject in school funding, right? We again saw this year a record number of referenda for school districts, in some cases, just trying to keep the lights on for a lot of places too, going into next year. We're probably going to see another 100 of them this spring, because a lot of districts, even in our part of the state, that are looking to referendum. But you brought up a great point in the last segment and also in the article you wrote for the CESA communication that goes out here in the southwestern part of the state, and talking about ways for communities to kind of get involved in this and work collaboratively between district, schools, city, community, county, trying to find ways forward. I keep thinking back to the fact that in Wisconsin, we're dealing with a big declining enrollment problem, of course, in rural public schools, but we're also dealing with declining population in communities. In western Wisconsin, I keep talking about declining birth rates to the point where they're setting records for the fewest number of births in the last, whatever decades that they've had. So these are all issues that go kind of hand in hand, which further complicates this dynamic between, how do we fund public schools? How do we move forward, especially in an age where really the only recourse for districts is to seek a referendum, right? This is not, they can't charge admission, they can't charge tuition. So that's kind of the recourse. So just to bring people back to it, the article you wrote highlighted an opportunity now for communities and school districts to partner and get involved. And one of the ways that you had talked about in the last segment was the local economic impact of the equivalent of bringing in businesses versus bringing in housing. And I thought that was an interesting note to make, because when we look at the housing market too, that's a whole other crisis on its own, right? In the state, my wife has worked in mortgaging for the last 10 years, so I'm very well aware of what's going on in that realm. These are all things that are really tied in.
Yeah, so I think one of, when we look at our rural areas, like southwestern Wisconsin, for example, we want it to stay the way that it is, right? We like our communities. We like our main streets. We love our communities the way they are. But then we have to be willing, then if we want things to stay currently where they are, then we have to realize that it's going to cost us more, because in order to enjoy all of the parts of the community, it comes at a cost. And if we're not promoting growth and we're not changing our communities, then we aren't bringing in more people to help offset those costs. And so I would say, when you think about recruitment of business, we have chambers and economic development corporations. That's their charge. That's the work they do. And it's really challenging, because there's a lot of factors that play into why a business might come in. And we think about trying to land that big fish that's going to start, 75 to 100 jobs. And in reality, if we're promoting small business that employs 5 to 7, and we can get 10 of those versus one big fish, if you will, they're likely not going to get the big tax breaks, right? They're investing for a reason. They want to invest in the community, and they're probably going to stay there. So putting your eggs in the basket with small business. Now, certainly we wouldn't turn away, the big companies that come in, obviously. But I think the crucial piece to that, the most crucial piece that I hear from our communities is housing. There's no housing available. There's not development. There's not money for development. And so getting more housing brings in more families. And when we talk about birth rates, in our area, that's a national trend. And so everybody's struggling with birth rates. But how do we get the families that are ready to settle down? Because they do. They go to the, like, from a rural standpoint, people go to the city, the hustle bustle, because that's where the money is. That's where the jobs are. And then our economic development leader here in Grant County calls it the boomerang effect. Then they come back around to the rural area where the family support is there, where it's, smaller community, simpler, so that they can spend more time with family. And so housing is huge. So there's two ways to go about that. One, and we're talking affordable housing too, right? So one is building affordable houses, which I don't, I'm 50 years old now. Affordable housing now is $400,000, right? I hear the term all the time. $400,000 is the new $200,000. And it just blows my mind, but that's what it costs to build a house. But the second is building community housing for retired folks who are hanging on to their home because they know it's paid for, they know the lay of the land, and they're comfortable. But building experiences in housing for some of our retired folks then frees up family housing. And so I think there's, those are a couple examples, but I think that's conversations that have to happen. And if it's not happening in the communities, and I'm promoting with our superintendents, they have to be more proactive. Just can't sit back and say, well, we're going to let it happen. I guess we'll go to referendum since nobody in the community is looking at growth. And so then, I'm not a big fan of the victim card. It's like, well, can't do anything about it. This is not our role. Well, it's going to have to become that role, or there has to be more collaboration, and somebody has to start that conversation. And and sometimes people are elected because they mean well, but maybe they don't have the background. But as you start having conversations, you start to learn, you start to understand, you start to reach out for resources. And then we have to have a spirit of collaboration in our communities if we're going to be able to make it through this crisis we're in with population through 2030.
Dr. Jamie Nutter is the agency administrator at CESA 3, offering a very interesting and I want to say more positive outlook on how we can move forward in terms of school funding. Jamie, thank you for all of your time. This has been amazing to have a conversation with somebody who's a leader in education and talk a bit about this. Thanks for your time, and hopefully look forward to having you back on again whenever I get to guest host one of these things.
Yeah, thanks for keeping the information on the forefront, Jimmy. Have a great day.
Big thanks to you, Jimmy. That's awesome. I always feel better when I learn something on a show from a guest, especially a guest who's so much more smarter than I am about these things. And I'm in this world. I'm a school board member. So this is stuff I actually like have to spend time in and learn about. So it is really cool to learn from, again, CESA 3 agency administrator, Dr. Jamie Nutter right there. Talking high school football in the next segment. Why not? Let's talk more about schools. And we'll do that coming up right after this. You're listening to the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media.
From Hobart to Bay Settlement, 97.9 WGBW. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For 97.9 WGBW News, I'm Lisa Hale. Bird flu has hit Wisconsin. It was found on a poultry farm in Barron County. The DATCP and the USDA are now working together with the operator. The next step is to euthanize all the birds on the property. That's standard procedure when the avian flu has been detected. None of the birds from the farm will enter the food system. Staying warm in Wisconsin usually means a bulkier coat, but that may not be the best option for your kids who still ride in car seats. Melissa Kay has more.
Puffy coats may keep your little one warm, but they won't keep them safe in a car seat.
So the car seat is supposed to keep your child in place so that they're not being jostled around during the car accident. But if the puffy coat is there, like I said, you can have some of that extra space in there, which could cause your child to slide around, which could lead to impact and whiplash that could be harmful to your child.
That's Jamie Oswald, MD, and a Spirus family medicine physician. She said even if you think you've cinched the straps tight, there may be a significant gap because of the bulk of the coat.
So the car seat is supposed to keep your child in place so that they're not being jostled around during the car accident. But if the puffy coat is there, like I said, you can have some of that extra space in there, which could cause your child to slide around, which could lead to impact and whiplash that could be harmful to your child.
Dr. Oswald said once you have your child strapped into the car seat, you can put a blanket over them to keep them warm. If you want to check if their coat is thin enough to use in the car seat, strap them in with it on. Then take the child out, take the coat off, and put them back into the car seat without adjusting the straps. If the straps are snug, it's okay. If there's gaps, the coat is too thick.
I'm Lisa Hale, 97.9 WGBW News. For news anytime, log on to WGBW.fm.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabe. Variety reports that there will be a new version of the film American Psycho. Good Lord. Even though this doesn't need to happen on any level, a new interpretation of the novel of the same name will star Austin Butler as Patrick Bateman. The red-hot Luca Guadagnino will direct the film. Guadagnino's two most recent efforts are Queer, starring Daniel Craig, and Challengers, starring Zendaya. Both films were nominated for Golden Globes. And things a really talented and incredibly famous guy says that nobody cares about news, the great Elton John says making marijuana legal in Canada and the U.S. is one of the greatest mistakes of all time. Exaggerate much? John was recently named Time Magazine's Icon of the Year and told Time Magazine that as a recovering addict, he believes marijuana is addictive. I'm not saying when he wrote Tiny Dancer, Rocket Man, or Benny and the Jets that he was high, but he might have been high. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabe, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A mostly cloudy sky for tonight, temperatures rising through the 20s. And more clouds for tomorrow, some rain and snow late, highs in the mid-30s. A rain and snow mix tomorrow night into early Sunday, then cloudy and a high in the low 40s for Sunday afternoon. Currently, we're at 15.
Mino and the Mayor.
I'm going to admit something that I normally would not admit. A lot of times I don't wear underwear.
We got to go to a break.
I don't have a cart, and I'm carrying this stuff.
Yeah.
I got my finger in the loop, holding my pants up, because they would literally go down. And twice, people stop me. Hey, John Mino, as I'm trying to hold my pants up and hold my stuff in my arms.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday morning 6 till 9 on 97.9 WGBW and 98.3 WISS. Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Here's why I'm glad I don't work in an office. My wife is always talking about, she's a teacher. They put donuts in the teacher's lounge. There's sweets, there's snacks. It wasn't that way here today, but Nikki keeps those Biscoff cookies out there. I probably ate 12 of those today. The phrase "you are what you eat" is very true, because I was sitting in the office earlier prepping the show and I felt kind of doughy and I'm like, I feel like a Biscoff cookie.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Pete Schwabe.
On the next Nightlight, Nikki Zurjev and I talk about our favorite comedies. Brittany Merlot gives us an overview of the weather this winter. And Terry Barr brings the tunes on a bar band Friday night.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
Fade is moving and the finger.
Welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media. I'm Jimmy Cuska, the sports director here at Civic Media, filling in today. I'll be back on Monday as well. Coming up in about a half an hour, it'll be Nightlight with Peach Schwaba. Stay tuned for that coming up at 6 o'clock. Joining me now to talk about the high school football playoff qualification and seeding plan is the head coach at Edgewood High School in Madison, Jesse Norris. Coach Norris, thank you for joining me. I am fascinated by this plan. I can't wait to talk about it with you. It is pretty neat to see some of those familiar names and faces that are doing this work for high school football. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me, Jimmy. I really appreciate it. Excited to jump on here and talk with you about this.
Well, I want to start just by asking, you know, going back to this past fall, the WIAA applying its tiebreakers, the unknown algorithm, things like that. Your program actually got caught kind of in the mix of that. It's an interesting situation for you, right? Because you were one of the programs kind of caught in that mix.
Yeah, it's kind of an anomaly in all reality. Like, I think that I'll be the first to admit that I think we were the recipient of a mess up. Obviously, the WIAA has come out and talked about it recently. I'll go round in circles here. I'm a little biased about my program, and I feel like, you know, we should have made it in, but at the end of the day, you know, the way that the intent of the rule or the intent of the tiebreakers were applied, I think that, you know, they came out and said that they made a mistake, and it is what it is, right? But I think it's perfect for the situation that we kind of are in right now, and it's allowed us to kind of make some headway really fast. This actually, you know, from how long it's been in the works, it's not as long as you probably think. I mean, it's something that I've always had in the back of my mind coming from Ohio and knowing what that system looks like. And I've messed around with it with my assistant, Andy LaVoy, who's probably the nuts and bolts of this entire situation. He kind of messed around with some things earlier when he was working with me back in 2022. And just now it's kind of come to fruition where we dug into it a lot more. And it's probably been about 6 weeks or so. I think we've really been heavy into it. 4 weeks since I actually presented it to the WFCA executive committee, and then we've kind of taken it, run with it from there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this proposal, because I think that when anything changes in high school football, I mean, the last big change was the conference realignment proposal, right? That's the last really significant everything change that we've had in Wisconsin. If it goes through, obviously it would affect the way that teams would qualify for the postseason. And the way it's being done and the way it's being presented is in the mode of transparency, right? Formula is there. The way teams would qualify and be seated is laid out for all to see. And it just an oversimplification of it. You earn points by beating other teams, which makes sense. And then there's different points awarded depending on the division of the school and the teams that they have beaten. That's an oversimplification, but I think just at its face, that part of it makes sense to me. What goes into the playoff qualification and seeding?
Yeah, I think when we set out to kind of work through this, transparency was the number one key, right? Like, that's something that as coaches talk about all the time. Is like, what is it that we need to fix, right? Like, as coaches, you know, we're constantly evaluating and upgrading and wanting to change and make changes in areas that we know that changes can be made. But if you don't know where or how the things are getting to the issue, right? Like with the WIA system right now, like, no one has any idea what the formula is or what the weights are or anything like that. So we don't know where fixes need to be made. And so I think with the system, transparency was the number one key in getting this in front of the coaching staffs and making sure that transparency is out there. And a simple formula, like you said, it really isn't an oversimplification. You generate points off of beating good teams. And we're not awarding points for losses at this point in time. I think that's something that's been in the discussion down the road. But I think the way that we have it set up right now is pretty good. The biggest change, I think, that we first are wanting to implement is separating the divisional placement prior to the season, which is something that every other sport in the state does already, and pretty much every other state in the country does already. I think we were the only ones that exits at the division postseason. And so now knowing what division you're in prior to the season and who the 52 teams are that you're competing against are going to be. And then each of those divisions has a point rank, so to speak. So starting at 6.5 with division one, and it kind of goes down by half a point each division to where division seven is 3.5 points. And actually 8-man is going to be 3 points, the way that kind of works out. So this will also go into effect for 8-man football as well. But then each team that you beat, depending on the level, is the team that you're generating those points. So you've got tier one and tier two points within the system. Tier one points are the defeated opponent's sum of points. So directly, you play nine games. You add up how many wins you have versus those divisions, and then you divide that entire score by nine. That gives you your tier one average. All right. Tier two is basically the sum of your defeated opponent's tier one points. So everyone is accumulating tier one points based off the teams that they beat. So then if I beat a team, you know, for a simplification idea is if you beat somebody in poker, you're accumulating their chips, right? So if I beat a team, I'm going to accumulate every chip that they've generated. And that way, and then I stack those up in my tier two stack, right? The way the tier two averages are calculated is we have a multiplier. So there's also a divisor and a multiplier. The divisor is the total number of games played within that schedule. So nine teams play nine games, that would be 81, would be the starting divisor. Anytime that you don't play a game, that divisor is lessened by one. We really think that that helps balance out teams that don't get a full nine-game schedule, and so on and so forth. Or if you play an eight-game schedule, it still kind of levels you out. I think this year Kimberly only played eight games, but they were still a top four seed based off of their wins and the number of points that they generated because of that divisor. I think their divisor was 72 compared to maybe Franklin's 81. So then the tier two points after you get you divide by the divisor, which would be the 81, you're going to multiply that by nine. So that's the multiplier there, which basically sets the strength of schedule. So that almost kind of gives you a 9x weight or value to those tier two points. So tier two points in this proposed system are very, very valuable. That's where you're going to make your money, so to speak. I think a lot of coaches, some of the questions and some of the misunderstanding with this is well, if I don't play higher divisions, I'm not going to earn as many points. And so I don't have the same opportunity as a D5 school that plays an entirely D5 schedule as a D5 school that has D4 and D3. While that is true, you might not be able to have the same opportunity to collect tier one points and the value of your tier one average. You do still have the ability to earn tier two points that can rank you higher than some of those other schools, right? Because at the end of the day, they got to win and you got to win, right? So if they're playing higher level teams, unless they're going and running through those higher level teams and beating them, right, then good for them. They've done a really good job of winning good games against teams that win, and then you're going to find that with the current system, like there are some teams that have got five wins that haven't made it, right? There was one team in Division Three that had a 5-4 record and they didn't make it. When you look at their tier two points, you know, they only had eight total wins in their entire schedule, right? So the teams that they beat hadn't beaten anybody. So they didn't accumulate tier two points. I think when in the long run with some of the ideas that people are worried about tier one points not having the same opportunity with playing up or down or what that looks like, you're going to find that it doesn't play as much. It doesn't come into play as much as what it would be with your tier two points and how you can stack those on top of each other.
We are having an algebra lesson with Coach Jesse Norris from Edgewood High School. I'm kidding. We are talking about playoff qualification in seeding in Wisconsin. Sorry. It's a talk show. We're allowed to have some fun here. So,
absolutely.
We
can make fun. Yeah.
You say Short mentioned like 9X and multiplier and divisor. And I'm just sitting here. I'm like, man, it has been 20 something years since I was in a math class. But it makes sense because its face, we're talking about playoff qualification and seeding being based on beating other teams, which I think when you oversimplify it like that, I think makes sense to, especially for people listening or probably sitting in their cars wondering why we're going through all this math. I think it's great to have the transparency in talking about what actually goes into what the system would be, because as we've talked about at the outset of this, and a lot of the feedback that has been put out publicly has been that the process right now isn't very transparent. It's not transparent because nobody knows what goes into it.
Right.
In our conference champion undefeated ends up a three seed playing the second team in our conference that was 7-2 in a 3-6 game. And then, of course, the three seed goes to state as a runner up. So I know, and that's just one very isolated example of several, I think, in this year's playoff field where people kind of scratch their heads at the seeding part of it. So in that part of it, it sounds like the seeding in the playoffs, first of all, which we will come back to just in the divisional setup, just a little bit on the seeding part of it. Not only is it just a ranking by teams by points, but there's also a geographic component to where teams are placed, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that was the next thing, is going to be making sure that, you know, we went through a lot of different options and we had a lot of different conversations, and I was working with the WFCA executive board hand in hand. And I worked with Kaminsky on this for a really, really long time. I met with the executive board for a bunch. I almost feel like I'm a part of the executive board at this point in time, but it's been fun to kind of have that experience. But I think, yeah, to your point, the geographic locations and trying to minimize travel, which is a big thing for the WIA, a major component. The other major component with WIA is regional representation. And so making sure that each area of the state has an opportunity to be represented was something that we set out to maintain, because we know that that's very important for them. And the way that we've kind of created our seeding, everything is going to be based off of the rank, right? So we don't seed just straight off the jump, right? So you're accumulating your rank within your division. That's what the tier one and tier two averages do, basically, is set your rank. And then the seeding is completed based off of your rank. So top one through four seeds are going to be top one through four ranks are going to be one seeds, and those basically set the brackets, A, B, C, and D. And then everything off of that is based off a location compared to those host teams, right? So one through four are your one seeds, five through eight are your two seeds, and so on and so forth. So every four teams is going to be your, every four ranks is going to be your seed, right? And then when you look at the location of travel, we're basically taking those, let's just start with the one seeds versus the eight seeds, right? So eight seeds are going to play one seeds no matter what, right? So of those four teams, we're basically geolocating the minimal amount of travel between those two teams, and those are the pairings. So if you're a 29 through 32 ranked, any of the 29 to 32 can play any of the one through four. So it isn't necessarily a one place 32. It could be a two place 29, one place 30, based on location. And so everything is kind of paired and within our algorithm within the program that's been built by Andy LaVoy, who's an assistant for me. It's all done instantaneously, just because of with the geolocation points that we have. And it's all done by a program and an algorithm provided by Tom Yashinsky from Onalaska. Put together a thing that's, we've got the travel distance basically per mile between each school. So that's built into the program. And what we found out by going through this example and by pairing everybody based off of location and distance, we've balanced the brackets significantly better than they've ever been balanced, because they're based off a rank within your division. And the body of work that's been done throughout the year. But we've only increased the travel component throughout the last 3 years of data that we've collected by an average of 10%. And so, you know, we're talking like that's maybe 15 to 20 minutes on average, longer, right? But I think for a balanced bracket, traveling a little bit longer, coaches, in all reality, if you're asking coaches, and I don't care, most of them don't care about travel. It's a Friday night. You're in the playoffs. You're playing level two, level three. I'll drive wherever to whatever field I need to play in. Let's just go play ball. I think that's the majority of coaches. Obviously, administration, I'm not going to speak for them. It's a little bit different, which is why we're still having this conversation about travel and things like that. But I do think that it balances things very nicely.
Coach, can you stick around just for a couple minutes so we'll wrap up our thoughts on this?
Absolutely.
All right, Coach Jesse Norris will join us on the other side. We're talking about the high school football playoff qualification, seeding, everything. We're going to talk more about that coming up. This is the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media. Coming up at the top of the hour, Nightly with Pete Schwabo.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Big news in Wisconsin this month. as much of the controversial anti-union Act 10 law was struck down in a ruling by Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jacob Frost. Two takeaways on this. One, the ruling gets at the heart of what has always made this law so brazenly political by defining public safety employees differently from general public employees. That decision was pretty clearly made not based on across-the-board policy, but on which unions backed Scott Walker for governor in 2010. It would be fitting if that is what ultimately spells the end for this controversial law. Secondly, this case is headed to an appeal, which almost certainly will end up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. While this case still might be decided by the court's current 4-3 liberal majority, it's a good reminder of just how important the upcoming race for state Supreme Court will be.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
It's the center of the Kringle-making world. Racine County wears the crown, and bakers like those at O&H create more than 10,000 of the delicate oval-shaped pastry every single day.
Just a great pastry. One that's hard to make, though, hard to replicate.
Peter Olison is a third-generation owner. O&H is celebrating its 75th year, but do you know if Wisconsin considers the Kringle our official pastry? The answer coming up.
The 500-square-foot corner bakery to offering our products by mail.
Baker Mike Massanellis says their Kringle is shipped near and far. The tradition began when the Danes came to Racine in the late 1800s, and it is that past and present which created our official state pastry, the Kringle, in 2013. And it's a you can't have just one slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
97.9 WGBW and WGBW.FM.
Welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media. I'm Jimmy Cuska, the sports director here. We are talking sports in this segment, because why not? I'm allowed. Coming up in about 10 minutes, it'll be Nightlight with Pete Schwabe, a show that I have been on a number of times. I'm sure he's got a lot of fun things planned for you coming up at the top of the hour. But right now, we're going to talk sports for just a few more minutes. We're talking again with Coach Jesse Norris from Edgewood High School in Madison about the proposal by the Coaches Association to change how teams qualify for the football postseason. We did a lot of math in the first part of this. This is going to be a little more, not vibes, but I just want to take a temperature check of where things are at. I know this week there were a couple of presentations to coaches about this, and a survey went out to head coaches. It sounded like there was almost immediate overwhelming feedback to it, as I think about a third of the coaches in the state responded within hours of the webinar on Wednesday in talking about this. So obviously a lot of people have thoughts about this system and where it's going to go. I can just speak anecdotally from our part of the state. There are people wondering, as we've covered the tier one part of it with all the small schools here. One part of it that I haven't heard talked a lot about either in the webinars, in the online discussions or anything, and it's been brought up to me by a couple of different people, is how do conferences play in this? Because now with all nine games being equal to the playoff qualification formula, do conferences matter? And I thought it was an interesting question, so I'll pose it to you. Was this ever brought up as part of discussions in developing this, how conferences might factor in to the system?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it, and again, we have an oversimplification viewpoint, and we look at it from a 300-foot view. If you really want to dive into it, the nine games, whoever it is you're playing, are the most important. I think the conferences matter just for the spirit of the game and all reality, because you added that competitive opponent. You have your like teams that have been playing together for a very long time. There's a very high competitive nature when it comes to conferences. And in all reality, that those are the games that are creating that layered approach when it comes to a football season. And so, when you look at an experience for a high school kid playing within a conference and competing for a conference championship, plays into that layered approach within the game of football. And so we still value the conferences very, very much. This is not an approach to limit the value of conferences at all. If anything, it's actually opportunities within the conferences, because, as you can see from this most recent realignment that was just issued the beginning of this week, there is now some like, oh man, like we need to really look at this, how this playoff matrix fits in with our new conference pairing. And there's a lot of buzz around it. So I don't think that this is going to diminish the idea of conferences and the competitive nature that the conferences bring to the football in the state of Wisconsin. I think the goal that we started out with was we wanted to make sure that the non-conferences games matter just as much, right? So beforehand, some of the conversations that I had were, I didn't want my non-conference games to matter because I wanted to go and play whoever I wanted without them affecting my ability to make playoffs. And I can understand that from that end of things. On my side of things, I felt like, you know, having two games in your schedule that didn't matter at all was a really tough situation to be in sometimes, and really wanted to make sure that those non-conference games matter. And now having that a part of it, that's a big, you know, that's a big opportunity for schools to really make a jump. You know, some of the arguments that I've heard is, well, I'm locked in. I've got 60%, 70% of my schedule, you know, made for me based on the conference realignment. So I have no choice in the matter of who I'm playing in conference. But what we do now is we've got those two non-conference games that we can have control over.
I only have a couple more minutes, so I want to wrap up with this. You know, the survey is out. Coaches get to provide some feedback. What are the next steps for this proposal, and how soon could action be taken on this proposal?
Yeah, so the survey is going to run through next Wednesday. I think right now with the data that we've got as of this morning, we were at like 87% for, which is a really good number. Still really want to make sure we're pushing to get as close to 100% involvement with this survey. And that's got to be key. I think that's the big thing that the WIA wants to see is how much support we're getting. The next steps are going to be once this closes next Wednesday, January 7th is when the WFCA Executive Board is going to meet with the WIAA on this, and it's going to be presented with the data that we have, all the information we've accumulated. And at that point in time, that's when it will go into a vote to pass through the WIAA. And then it'll go through the phases of, you know, however many committees that it needs to run through within the WIAA and ultimately get approved. The goal is to get this in line and ready to go for next season. So we want this to be able to run for the 2025 season come August.
Coach Jesse Norris from Edgewood High School, I really appreciate the time and the insight into this process because I think one thing that when we think about high school sports in Wisconsin, we think of it as it's a top-down system. The orders come from the top, marches down. This is something that's coming from the other end where a group of coaches gotten together, saw a problem, worked to kind of help fix it, work towards a better solution for all. And it is great to see there's a very robust community of high school football coaches willing to provide feedback and input for your plan. I appreciate all the time. Thank you for explaining this all. The math part of it's probably going to elude me, but the rest of it makes a lot of sense to me. Thanks for your time, Coach.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. Appreciate you having me on.
Now, if you want to learn more about this, of course, you can go right to the Football Coaches Association website, WIFCA.org. There's also a piece up at civicmedia.us or your local station website if you want to check it out, learn more about that high school football proposal. Big thanks to everybody who is part of the show today, the alliterative edition of the Dom Salvia Show, James Kelly, as well as Dr. Jamie Nutter, and of course, Jesse Norris, who you just heard from there, our producer, Jess P.S., and myself, Jimmy Cuska. We make way for Pete Schwabba and Nightlight that comes your way next. You've been listening to the Dom Salvia Show here on Civic Media. Have a great evening, everybody.
Remind me how this is the same old story of growing up and getting lost. Sit out. Remind me how this is the same old story of growing up and getting lost. Sit out. This is the same old story of growing up and getting lost. Now, remind me how this is the same old story of growing up and getting lost.
From Denmark to De Pere, this is 97.9 WGBW. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we continue our live coverage from the Seattle area, focusing on the Naval Air Station in Bremerton. Join us then.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, Give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. Public outcry over reported drone sightings in the Northeast and other parts of the country. Residents and lawmakers demanding more information.
Former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan saying he witnessed dozens of large drones above his house for 45 minutes. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy sending a letter to President Biden saying more resources are needed to fully understand what is behind this activity. Drones also seen over parts of New York City. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says there is no evidence the reported drones pose any threat or are tied to a foreign country.
ABC's Perry Russum. During a congressional trip, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi hospitalized in Luxembourg. Her office says she sustained an injury during a ceremony marking the 80th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge, but did not provide details of her injuries. Heavy snow and ice in the forecast from the Midwest to the Northeast. Residents in the Great Lakes getting more snow. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hayes.